Welcome to The Environment Show, exploring issues and events of the planet. I'm Thomas Lally. The Environment Show is a national production made possible by Hemmings Motor News, a monthly Bible of the old car hobby from Bennington, Vermont, 1-800-C-A-R-H-E-R-E, and the Bullitt Foundation. Your host is Peter Burley.
Thanks, Thomas. Coming up on this week's Environment Show. While environmentalists frequently preach gloom and doom, real progress is being made in efforts to improve air quality. We speak to Undersecretary of State Timothy Wirth about a strengthened American resolve to cut back the global output of harmful greenhouse gas emissions. An agreement which aims to reduce smog at the Grand Canyon National Park has been reached among people who historically have been adversaries. A story about how new technology is cleaning the air. And in our Earth calendar, we feast with the grizzly bears in Alaska. These stories and more coming up this week on The Environment Show. The United States has changed its position regarding greenhouse gas emissions, putting pressure on other countries to follow suit. Some of these are gases caused by burning fossil fuels like oil and coal. The position change was announced in a speech by Undersecretary of State Timothy Wirth to representatives of the countries that signed the Framework Convention on Climate Change. Wirth called for binding commitments. When the Climate Change Convention was signed in Montreal during the Bush administration, the U.S. opposed binding commitments and favored voluntary targets instead. Under a system called for by Wirth, each nation would pledge to discharge only a prescribed amount of greenhouse gases like carbon dioxide, and if the targets were not met, violating nations would face sanctions. Many believe that without enforceable limits, countries will continue to create more and more greenhouse gases, which in turn will increase global warming and the tempestuous weather conditions associated with it. Undersecretary Wirth comments on why binding commitments are necessary.
Over the last number of years, the international community has attempted to meet the commitments of the Climate Change Treaty with voluntary actions. It's very clear that those just aren't going to work. We call for binding targets. Now, what do we mean by that? By legally binding, we mean that these are targets that all nations have to agree upon and commit themselves to. And it also means that we're moving ahead on the treaty itself, that people cannot talk about the treaty and not do anything about it. We have to talk and act at the same time.
In order to meet binding targets, nations will have to figure out what their emissions are and figure out how to limit them in the future. This could require burning of cleaner fuels like natural gas instead of coal, meeting future energy needs through non-polluting sources like fuel cells, wind or the rays of the sun, and cleaning up auto exhaust. It will be up to each country to figure out what steps it will take to meet the targets. Opponents to setting up enforceable limits include countries that sell or rely heavily on coal and oil, as well as the producers themselves. Representatives of the coal and oil industries lobbied the Bush administration successfully to oppose enforceable limits when the Climate Change Convention was originally signed. Developing nations are also fearful of limits, which could impede their economic growth.
One of the most interesting questions that we face is the role of the developed world versus the role of the developing world. Clearly, it's the developed world that has put most of the greenhouse gases into the atmosphere so far. But looking down the line into the 21st century, it is India, China, Brazil, Indonesia. They're going to be major emitters of greenhouse gases in the future. So we have to engage those countries, and we're embarked upon a very ambitious diplomatic and economic set of initiatives with the Chinese, with the Indians, with the Brazilians.
Timothy Wirth is the U.S. Undersecretary of State for Global Affairs. The next step now is for nations to agree on the actual emission targets that will be set and to agree on how they will be enforced. Difficult as the process may be, the change in U.S. policy to favoring binding commitments to limit greenhouse gases is of major significance in the global effort to deal with human-induced climate change. Philosophers have asked whether a tree falling in the forest makes a noise if no one ever hears it. Similarly, tourists in the next century might ask if the Grand Canyon exists if they can't see it. The problem is increasing air pollution. Haze has made it harder and harder to see the grandeur of the canyon. Now there is hope the trend can be reversed. A commission established 5 years ago, including representatives from 8 state governments, tribal nations, public agencies, environmental groups, utilities, industries, and the public at large, has come up with a series of recommendations which the EPA will now incorporate into a regional air pollution control plan. Just about everybody involved sees the agreement on recommendations as a historic event. Rick Moore, Air Quality Program Director of the Grand Canyon Trust, an environmental group, participated in the process.
There are still days that are extremely clear at the canyon. However, the National Park Service has indicated that they experience some kind of impairment of visibility at Grand Canyon 90% of the time. So this agreement was put together in an attempt to try and address that degrading visibility and, if possible, turn it around.
The haze is caused by pollution from many sources, including power plants and smelters, cities and automobiles, dust from unpaved roads, industry and forest fires. A major concern was how to control pollution from coal-burning power plants in the region and whether to put a cap on future discharges.
The main part of the agreements that we are very interested in as an environmental organization was that the utility companies have agreed to reduce their emissions of sulfur dioxides approximately 13% by the year 2000 and anywhere from 50 to 70% by 2040.
Rick Moore is Air Quality Program Director with the Grand Canyon Trust. Ed Fox, Vice President for Environmental Health and Safety at Arizona Public Service, the state's largest investor-owned utility, is equally enthusiastic.
I think the entire process is really historic. You brought more than 60 stakeholders together over a four-year period of time to look at visibility issues in the West and how they impact not just the Grand Canyon, but other Class 1 parks and pristine areas in the West, and basically came to a consensus resolution on how to move forward to protect and improve the visibility in those parks and in those pristine areas. So I think just on the process side, it really was historic. On the more substantive side, I think there were significant commitments were made, certainly from the stationary sources like utilities, where we have pretty much committed to a certain level of emissions and emissions reductions over the next 40 years that will see significant improvement associated with visibility, at least as they relate to those stationary sources.
Of the 8 participating states, only Nevada refused to sign on to the Commission's recommendations. Lou Dodgen, administrator of the Nevada Division of Environmental Protection, states the reasons.
The report shows that road dust represents approximately 31% of the man-caused visibility impairment in the canyon, and that emissions from Mexico are approximately 19.6%. And those are not dealt with in this recommendation. And given that they were not dealt with, we felt that we couldn't support a recommendation that would put mandatory emissions limits in the Clean Air Corridor. And we feel that if you're going to improve visibility in the Grand Canyon and the other parks on the Colorado Plateau, you have got to deal with these road emissions, road dust emissions, and emissions out of Mexico. And that was the basis for our negative vote.
The Navajo Nation and other Indian tribes were represented in the deliberations by David Kelly, environmental specialist for the Navajo Air Quality Control Program of the Navajo EPA. The Navajos have a major stake in the outcome, not only because they live in the airshed, but also because both coal mines and major power plants are located on tribal lands. Rather than continue the emissions inventory and await changes in existing power plants that are already taking place under the Clean Air Act, Kelly preferred a more proactive approach.
I would much rather have seen a timeline where we say, okay, this facility will install a scrubber system or start on a scrubber system installation by this time frame and will have it operational by this time frame, whatever. That would have been much more appropriate, I think, but that's not happening here.
Just about everybody agrees that drawing up a plan based on the recommendations of the commission is far more likely to produce success than the old way of doing things. It used to be that the federal EPA would draw up the plan and hand it out for comment. With a proposal before them that nobody had seen before, slugging matches would invariably break out between environmentalists, industry, EPA, and everyone else affected. I caught up with Felicia Marcus, the regional administrator for the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency for the Southwest and Pacific, in a truck stop in the desert as she was heading to a meeting, and asked her what our children can expect when they go to the Grand Canyon 10 or 15 years from now.
And from a strict results point of view, I think they will see no further degradation of the Grand Canyon. Secondly, I think they will see far more of the Grand Canyon. And thirdly, and just as important, if not more important, they will see their government agencies at all levels working together and with tribes and with the people that they serve to solve a problem. And government working better, bringing people together and moving forward, I think is perhaps the most significant achievement to come out of this process.
Whether our children will think governments working together is as awe-inspiring as the Grand Canyon is debatable. But there is no question that the work of the Grand Canyon Visibility Transport Commission shows that a common approach to big, complicated environmental problems is possible, and that in the right framework, states, tribes, environmentalists, and industry can reach agreement. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Still ahead. A storyteller reminds us that experiences enhance our memories of places. We hear about technology that improves air quality and business bottom line. And in our Earth calendar, we feast on salmon with Alaskan grizzly bears. These stories still ahead on The Environment Show. People have differing views about their surroundings and how they should be protected. Laura J. Bobrow, storyteller from Mount Vernon, New York, and special projects coordinator for an organization called Nature in Legend and Story, reminds us that our experiences frequently define our impressions of places, and dangers felt by some may not even be perceived by others.
I was thinking the other day about the importance of place in stories. Not the setting of the story itself, but the place in which a story is heard. So it follows that all of us can know the same story and agree absolutely about the plot. But depending upon the circumstances in which we first heard it, each of our stories has another story running underneath it. And that story is different. That's kind of interesting to think about when people are trying to agree on something. And that, of course, reminds me of a story. It's an old Burmese tale about a mouse and an elephant. In a clearing, in the forest, there was a great crashing noise and the sound of pounding feet. Into the clearing rushed an elephant who stood there panting, ahoom, ahoom. And right after him came a little mouse. The mouse ran up the elephant's leg, across the elephant's back, and down to the end of the elephant's trunk. And the mouse sat there panting. Ooh, ooh. When they had calmed down a little bit, the mouse asked the elephant, "What happened to you?" "Oh," groaned the elephant, I met a rogue elephant. And rather than fight with him, I turned and ran. But I ran under a tree whose branches were too low. One of the branches made a deep gash in my side. It is so painful. And if you care to look, you'll see that it is fully 2 feet long. Oh, I'm sure that must be very uncomfortable, said the mouse. But at least you are not in danger of your life the way I was. The rogue elephant wouldn't have killed you, and the branch couldn't have cut deep enough to reach your heart. But listen to what happened to me. I was chased by a wild cat, and he almost caught me. He jabbed at me with his claws, and I escaped, but his claws left a gash in my side fully 2 feet long. My little friend, said the elephant, I don't mean to call you a liar, but from the tip of your nose to the end of your tail, you're not even 1 foot long. That may be so, O great one, said the mouse, and he held up his tiny little paw, but to each his own foot.
Laura J. Bobro is a storyteller from Mount Vernon, New York. We've seen that open places like the Grand Canyon aren't safe from air pollution. Cutting back on pollution can be costly, but as Environment Show producer Thomas Lally reports, sophisticated technology has improved both the air and the way business operates.
Everybody knows that cars and trucks produce air pollution. Just stand next to any interstate and take a deep breath. But there are a lot of other sources of air pollution. Many are not at all obvious. In the Los Angeles area, which has the worst air in the country, about half of the air pollution is caused by mobile sources, like cars, trucks, and even lawnmowers. The other half is created by stationary sources, which means anything from smokestacks to your neighborhood dry cleaner, all the way down to your model plane building project in your basement. This is a far cry from the traditional picture of air pollution, which often conjures up visions of heavy industry with thick black smoke belching from tall stacks.
In terms of smokestack industry, I think in the United States primarily, it's almost all gone. More or less, most of the smoke is really contained, recirculated, or disposed of.
Pradeep Sharma works for Southern California Edison, a utility company which has worked hard to improve the area's air. He says that today, air pollution comes from a variety of sources, which affect the air by causing smog, destroying the ozone layer, and contributing to global warming.
The step that is getting most emphasis is avoidance. Is, well, if we don't produce them in the first place, then I think we're in a lot better position not to have to control them and incur more expense. So to do that, you'll see that more and more of the painting operations are now getting converted to powder coating. In a powder coating gun, it's like an electric charge is given to the paint once it comes out of the gun. And then the opposite charge exists on the panel or the surface which has to be painted. Since there's an opposite electric charge on the panel, it'll attract all the powder and not let it go anywhere. So these technologies not only do the job fast, they increase productivity, but they are also very durable. And in fact, for a common person on the street, if he looks at his refrigerator, if he looks at his dryer, his dishwasher, all the painting on those parts, I would say that most of these have been powder coated, and that's the kind of glossy, shiny surface that you'll get with powder paint.
Sharma says the air in Los Angeles has improved at the same time the population has doubled and the amount of cars has quadrupled. He credits strict air standards that have been enforced over the last 25 years, which have spurred on technology to deal with pollution from a vast array of sources. One major source is paint, which often includes about 5 to 6 pounds of solvent per gallon. These solvents evaporate and pollute the air. That's why paint in a can dries up if left uncovered. Ken Maiella is with the Glidden Paint Company, which has vowed to replace all their solvent-based paints with those made with water by the year 2000.
If you were to open up this can of, say, Glidden's LifeMaster 2000 VOC-free paint, you would not notice anything different in the can. It still looks like a creamy liquid, just like any other paint can. But what you would notice right away is there's virtually no paint odor. And so basically, simply to the eye, no VOC paint looks like any other paint. But the key is really the odor, the smell, the senses of the product.
Part of the problem with air pollution is that there are so many sources. And we're talking about air, which is hard to see, much less keep from going in the atmosphere. It's unrealistic to expect a mom-and-pop dry cleaning store to invest in expensive equipment the way big industry can. One new technology being developed at the Los Alamos National Laboratory in New Mexico is called cold plasma technology, which promises to provide inexpensive ways of cutting back on pollution. John Coogan is a scientist there. He says the process works by breaking down polluting substances into less harmful ones.
What we're trying to do is use electrical energy, keep the system near room temperature, but then break it apart. So say for a chlorinated compound, ultimately what we're shooting for is to take all the carbon in that compound to CO2, all the hydrogen in that compound to water, and all the chlorine to a simple acid that you can then scrub out and make salt out of. So the end products hopefully are CO2, water, and salt.
So you essentially charge the materials electrically rather than burn them up.
That's right. Instead of using thermal energy to break apart the hazardous compounds, we'll use energetic electrons in the discharge to break them apart.
Another strategy is to dry paint quickly before a lot of solvents can escape into the air. Pradeep Sharma of Southern California Edison explains that curing or drying substances that create air pollution, like paint for cars or ink for newspapers, can be achieved using ultraviolet and infrared light. And the list goes on. High-tech industries which need ultra-clean parts are today using water-based cleaners instead of solvents. Spray guns for paint are being designed to be incredibly efficient. Essentially, all industries have spent the past 25 years reviewing their operations to conform with laws that have improved our air quality. This technology has not only helped the air, but has also made industry more efficient and effective. For the Environment Show, I'm Thomas Lally.
And now it's time for the Earth Calendar. You worry about whether too much fatty mayonnaise on a sandwich at your summer picnic will upset your diet. But right now, 32,000 brown bears in Alaska are obsessed with the idea of getting as much of anything edible in their stomachs as fast as possible.
They are eating as much as they can. In different parts of the state, they hibernate for different lengths of time, but they can spend up to 7 months in a den where they don't eat, they don't drink, and they don't even get out of the den at all. So this time of year, they're gaining a tremendous amount of weight, and they can lose a tremendous amount of weight over that long winter. They're eating a lot of vegetation, a lot of grass. They're eating fish, salmon, preferably the fat skin part and the heads where there's a lot of fat in there. And they're eating dead animals. They tend to prey on moose calves during the entire summer months, caribou calves early when caribou are first on the ground. The newborn caribou grizzly bears prey on, but they tend to prey on moose calves all summer long. And they're eating as much as they can all summer.
Kathy Harms is a wildlife biologist for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. I've seen brown bears, or grizzlies, catching fish one after another for hours at a time in the streams of Alaska's Admiralty Island. They pursue their prey with an intensity that rivals Isaac Walton. Big old bears deftly scoop salmon out of the stream with a flick of the wrist that hardly disturbs the water. Young bears, still unskilled, splash around and make a big commotion, but the objective is the same. Stuff as much into the mouth and gain as much weight as possible. Inland, on the lower slopes of Mount Denali, grizzlies crisscross the big open spaces, scooping berries off low shrubs with such concentration they pay no attention to visitors who gawk at them from the road into the park. So when you're at the family picnic, Don't restrain that urge to gorge yourself with all that greasy potato salad, marshmallows, hot dogs, cake, hamburgers, salmon rolls, and watermelon and dessert. Do it all summer. You'll be responding to bare natural instinct, and the consequences will not be as grisly as your relatives might expect if you sleep it off in the winter. Thanks for being with us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-323-9262 and ask for program number 343. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Thomas Lally is the producer, Stephanie Goishman provided additional production support, and Dr. Alan Shartok is the executive producer. The Environment Show is made possible by Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the old car hobby, 1-800-CAR-HERE, and the Bullitt Foundation. So long, and join us next week for the Environment Show.